So I'll just begin the talk, and it's customary to just begin with the homage to the Triple Gem. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So I think it's the introduction this evening's session. Comment was made at visiting, and I've been over 3 months in solitary retreat in Bodhinyana Monastery, a very beautifully kept monastery, and physically beautifully kept, but also beautifully kept in terms of the heart, in terms of the Dhamma practice, and felt privileged to receive the hospitality and care. The resident sangha, 3.5 months, and during that time there was no contact, no speaking, no letters, no phones, no, didn't even caught a glimpse of people occasionally as they delivered the food to a particular place. So my speech faculty has gone a bit rusty. Yesterday I was at tea time with the monks, so I've been getting a bit up to speed again. So I find myself sometimes missing words, forgotten words, so I hope you bear this in mind. Also, I'm not entirely aware of you know, where each and every one of you are at in terms of your practice, your Dhamma practice, so I thought I would just give a rather general theme, something that's intrigued me and been on my mind for some time. It's about seeing the Buddha's teaching, which we can see as the suffering and the end of suffering, or unsatisfactoriness and the end of unsatisfactoriness. There's a standard way of expressing it. Another way of expressing it is karma and the end of karma. Karma and the karma that leads to the end of karma. And so this is what I'll talk about this evening. Karma and the karma that leads to the end of karma. And how is that relevant to the message of cessation of dukkha? And to me it's very relevant and very important, because this is what unifies the entirety of our Dhamma practice, from meditation, what we call meditation, to our daily life, that we speak, act, our relationships with people. Everything that we can do and experience can be brought into this particular theme, karma and the end of karma. Now it seems that very often in meditation, I don't know exactly what you hear, but there's a lot of emphasis on the being in the here and now and the present, and of course this is valuable. But when you recognize that being in the here and now is like putting a dipstick into an engine, you know, you dip down into the here and now, and what you're actually witnessing in the here and now is karma. Or the ending of it. And so the Buddha's awakening, on his own night of awakening, was insight and awareness into this very process. If you recognize the three knowledges the Buddha came to his night of awakening, first knowledge was this awareness of his own previous lives. So, you know, there's some sense in which he's witnessing not just, you know, any old present moment, but a present moment seen as a photograph or a readout of a whole process, which has been an extremely long process. Process where he began to recognize there's a continuity here. I was this, then I was that. I was born here, and then I passed away, and I rose here, and I passed away. What is he actually witnessing? What's being seen? We're seeing, instead of some being some fragment, some self that's just born for one lifetime and finished, and that's it, like a little chip, it's actually you're witnessing what we often sense ourselves as being just this one particular entity. No, that's not it. What you're witnessing is you're witnessing a present moment hologram of a wave that's going through life after life after life. And what we term ourself is really just one particular holographic, you know, photograph, if you like, or image right now of what this wave contains right now. This is his first true knowledge. And there's something awesome about that. That we're witnessing a current that's moving along. There's a dynamic flow that's happening. You know, this is his first awakening. Can you imagine? You get the really what that brings around. Rather than began here and end there, and that's the end of it. It's a unique thing. Yeah. It's something that's made of all kinds of strands of tendencies and inclinations and biases. And they don't just end. They go on. And they create new things and create new forms, just the way that, the currents of the ocean, you know, bring up these waves and forms and keep flowing backwards and forwards. And there's a sense also of how there's a weariness about that. It just goes on. It goes on. It's like that. You're in something that doesn't actually come to a curtain, that's the end, or a conclusion. It's just flowing on and on and on. And in that flow, one experiences birth, aging, joy, happiness, separation from the loved, sickness, pain, death, and another one, the same, again and again and again. So, first awakening, this is what we're with. And then second true knowledge is how this is happening for all kinds of beings, second true knowledge, and what's driving that current is certain ethical trends. According to the ethical quality of this person's deeds, they arose here and this happened to them and they passed away in that state. According to the ethical quality of this person's deeds, they arose here and they passed away in that state. That is the, if you like, the dynamic behind this wave flow is ethical. It's to do with virtue. It's to do with these inclinations. And this is the nugget, if you like, of karma. Karma is simply translated as action. But there's another implication to this action. This action is actually ethically driven. So the famous definition the Buddha gives to karma is volition, is will or intention. It's a particular drive. And that drive has got an ethical basis in it. It's virtuous, it's greedy, or it's fearful, or it's generous, or it's got this quality to it. So this drive that's ethically driven for good or for bad, and that's what's pushing the current along. It means that whatever we do, there's going to be a result to that, in terms of good or in terms of bad. And the big thing to remember is that every moment we have a choice. We often slip over that choice. We don't think we have a choice, or we miss the opportunity to make the choice. Every moment we have some choice to drive towards what's good or virtuous or skillful, or what's unskillful. We may miss the opportunity, mind may be blurred or distracted, so we just go into automatic or we're driven along. So it's important to, the first thing that's important is come out of distraction so you can make those choices. So the wave is not just running, you've got some way in which it's steered. And this is where, of course, we, from basic this understanding of the nature of cause and effect, we are deeply encouraged for our own welfare to be mindful. To really have that quality of attention that is there to allow us to make the choices. These choices that will have significant effects in our lives. And when you fully kind of fill out the quality of ethics and virtue, we're looking at things like, not just obvious things like, you know, violence or hatred or love, but things like depression, anxiety. Do you want to stay with that? Do you want to stay with grudge or guilt or regret? Or can you make a choice to just put that aside? Come out of that, see things another way. Which way, you know, do we want the wave to go? Have a significant effect on our lives, because essentially it's going to be for our own well-being. So the third true knowledge the Buddha comes to is this understanding of what are called the taints or the asava. And you can understand these as fundamental biases, like the mind is biased. So those waves are running in a particular direction. This fundamental bias is there. And all those biases are actually taking us towards suffering. We don't know that, because the quality of awareness has not really steadied and spread and surveyed and understood that. Or perhaps we haven't really encouraged or have the faith to understand as an option. We just think, well, that's the way it is. You have to go that way. And the biases are essentially towards happiness, gratification through sense contact. So it's very fundamental, isn't it? Be happy, go out shopping. It's not gross. Deprave, but just go and have something nice to eat or drink. Nothing wrong with that as a moral statement. But in terms of the bias, it's saying, you will get better if you buy something. Consumer ethic feeds into this bias. Sense contact will make you happy. And just you really take the time to notice, does it? You think, well, it does. For 3 minutes. A thing of beauty is a joy for 5 minutes. And then it doesn't last, does it? It's interchangeable. Otherwise, I'm sure that, we could have been blissed out by now. So this, And you begin to wake up to it, but of course, a lot of what's in the media and the commercial world is definitely determined to give you that message. So you've got to actually push against that bias. Just check it out. And how good is that? How good is the happiness of that? The sort of buzz, the flush of it. And the other bias is towards becoming something, you know, developing, becoming, getting status, could be that, develop something, change into something else. We will get better. So, you know, and without that we may think life is really despairing, depressing. Surely we're here to get to become something other than we are, you know, become something better. And yet you realize, do you ever get to the place where it's enough? You know, everything you've got there, and that's it. Now you can quit, you can retire, and just really feel completely contented. Or is there something else one has to know, do, change, make, alter, fix, remember, plan for, sort out? You know, do you ever become something that's actually satisfied? And we see, well, you get, you know, house is okay, garden's okay, you know, kids are okay. Still kind of restless, you know, fretful, get upset with things. I work on myself, try and get my mind sorted out. You know, never going to end. So there's fundamental bias that actually keeps believing in that. And actually, with this one is so fundamental that we even follow it in meditation for a way. So yeah, you can get better, you can become better, you can become calm, you can become, feel better. So this is the best kind of becoming. It's a very fundamental bias. Because this becoming can take you to a place where you get steady enough and calm enough for your awareness to begin to comprehend. It's no longer agitated, it's soothed, it's steadied, you can comprehend, hey, what's the basic view here? And no, wait a minute, I don't need to be in this game anymore. You can quit, give up, relinquishment, which is the culmination of the Buddhist path. It is very fundamental. And the third fundamental bias is the bias towards avidya, or ignorance, or not seeing, towards distraction, delusion, wrong views, you know, filling the mind up with all kinds of views and ideas that don't go anywhere, and not aligning oneself to views that take you to the ending of suffering. And all these are actually, you know, being activated. So once we begin to understand the whole process that we're in, inexorably in, be in for a long time, yeah, endless in fact, the Buddha says, and say, yeah, but actually you've got some choice here. And then you start making a choice, and you start developing choice. And as you make the right choices, your ability to make choice becomes more powerful and more penetrative. Yeah. So it's said of the Arahant Sariputta, he could choose whatever mind state he wanted to be in the morning, in the afternoon. He could choose whether he wanted to be on, you know, jhana, informal, you know, formless realms. He could actually determine to that extent where he was going to abide. Maybe not many of us have that possibility, but we can start to make choices about whether we want to, you know, be agitated, whether we want to be forgiving, whether we want to be calm, whether we want to be settled, whether we want to really come to terms with the stress and suffering of our life, or whether we want to keep feeding into these biases that generate and power it. So working or understanding karma, the nature of cause and effect, is giving us a place and a way, an opportunity to operate this sense of choice. And the sense of choice becomes based upon ethics, and then from ethics into well-being, or the ending of suffering, ending of stress. And the two fit together. So one of the most beautiful ways of understanding the comprehensiveness of the Buddhist path is it's essentially virtue, truth, and well-being are an inseparable trio. You can't have well-being without virtue. You can't have truth without virtue. Virtue is not so that you're morally superior or that you're in the right camp. Virtue for your welfare and for your clarity. And these three are inseparable. So, you know, and so that whatever, when we're practicing in daily lives, you say, well, you know, I can practice on the terms of my ethics, or I can practice in terms of my well-being. How do these two come together? If my well-being is not based upon ethics, it's got no ethical foundation, I don't trust it. You know? It's probably going to be a well-being that's based upon these biases. It's kind of tainted, perhaps unconsciously, with elements of greed, selfishness, disparagement of others and so forth, the triumphant putting down of other people, righteousness, vindictiveness, revenge, you know, serves him right, this kind of thing. So when you get this kind of these buzzes of happiness through the misfortune of others, you think, wait a minute, this isn't the well-being that's based upon virtue. The truth is missing here. So it's just to kind of recognize these three when they come together. Now, in our daily life, we might say that the three primary basis for how we conduct ourselves is terms of renunciation and kindness and compassion. This may seem very simple, very simplistic, but it's like you can recognize that all the colors and tones that we can perceive actually come from three primary colors: blue, red, and yellow. Every kind of tint and pink and green and olive and brown comes from just these three primaries. Similarly, all the skills of virtue come from three primary foundations, three primary colors, if you like. You can see when you understand the spirit of renunciation. Renunciation is about letting go of sense, the sense pull, but it's also about modesty, isn't it? You know, I relinquish that pride, that sense of, you know, the becoming, the me being special and superior. I can relinquish pride. You know, I can renounce that, let go of that. So it's about modesty. It's about humility. It's about patience. You know, when you really kind of tease out the implications of really developing renunciation in your life, and this is not hair shirt stuff. It's a renunciation that is for this immediate, intimate quality of well-being, what it feels like when you let go of something, you feel contented, you feel clear, and you feel purer. Because essentially, one of the realizations that we come to in contemplating and being more honest and truthful about ourselves is that we are actually, all human beings are ethical. We are ethical creatures. Every one of us has conscience, a moral conscience, and concern. So if we act in ways that are immoral, and what does this really mean? It means that we lose the sense of to others as to myself. This, if you like, is the fundamental law of morality. We do to others as we do to ourselves. So we refrain from violence, from dismissiveness, from cutting, from stealing and so on. We don't do that to others because we don't want to have this happen to ourselves. To others as to myself. So when we live like that, there's a sense of we feel clear. Whenever we tune into that, we feel clearer and we feel wider, we feel more open. There's nothing to hide, there's no secrets, there's nothing you've got to be underhanded about. So this is what it is to live with virtue, is to have this sense of how it makes you feel freer. Because it's true that we are actually are ethically based beings. We have conscience, we have concern for others, we have concern how other people regard us. Yeah. So we want to be seen in a caring and loving way. We don't have to defend ourselves, be secretive. This is just the kind of actually the beauty of what it is to be a human being, is to have this is your basis, this ethical basis, conscience and concern, hiriyotapa. So, you know, when we develop the ethics, you know, renunciation, I'm not kind of pushing myself, grabbing, greedy, demanding, trying to force everything to be my way, trying to make the world fit into just for my well-being alone. So there's a quality in which one lets go of that. There's something to develop. This is not a kind of ascetic practice or a practice just for people who've gone forth. Each and every one of us can practice that, you know. So you learn to be contented with what's necessary in terms of sensory requirements. And then also learning to relinquish this demanding or the proud conceitedness that we can become prey to, or vanity. Second basis of non-anger. Yeah, there's a sense of friendliness. Now we all actually, we like to be that. We want to be that. We enjoy being that. It feels nice. It feels natural. We feel we can flow with that friendliness. We can relax with friendliness. So it feels good. And then avihimsa, or non-violence, means not just physical violence, it means the violence of our tongues, the cut, the sarcasm, the dismissiveness, the harshness, cursing, and the many ways in which we can wound people or belittle people. So we distasteful. I don't want somebody to do that to me. I want to not do that to others. And you can actually find that, you know, unconsciously you pick up language, which, you know, street language, which is doing that without even really knowing you're doing it. You know, abusing, cursing, caricaturing, belittling people. And it's kind of fun. And this is part of the whole kind of bias that we have to come out of. Really, what are we saying? Why? So when these three mix together, you get the sense in which there's a real recognition of the intimate value of being clear and making choices and about how we verbally act, verbal karma, bodily karma, and then even the kind of moods, emotions, energies, inclinations, drives that we encourage. The karma of the heart, the karma of the citta, the karma of the mind, which is the most important, the leader. There's no point in just kind of mimicking particular words that sound good if you haven't actually got it in the heart. This is the leader of them, isn't it? And then when you mix these things, you realize that if you put renunciation and compassion together, you get something like the wish to serve others. I'll give up some of my time and help you. You mix renunciation and loving kindness, you get something like generosity. I'll give up some of mine and I'll nourish you. You know, so you see how these blend in a whole range of wonderful qualities that we can bring forth as human beings. These three primaries. And it isn't, you know, just to see, you can be creative like that, how one can actually develop a generous. Now one could see, oh, yeah, if I let go of that and incline that way, that will, you know, bring around this and I'll feel good. And I'll live in a place and in a relationships and in a where there's a goodwill and there's trust and there's humour and it's alive. It's the people aren't tense and defensive and grudging, bitter. No, wonderful. We can make this choice. Now, as we recognize that the whole sense of sila is seamless, but it does flow into the what we call the development of samadhi, or meditation. Because now in meditation, taking the time to bring another important factor, which is a quality of mindful awareness, which right now we're going to be really fully aware of the current, the wave currents, and there are often many of them. The Buddha said there's different kinds of karma currents. There's dark, that which leads to dark, tight, congested, negative states. There's bright, which lead to bright, radiant, beautiful states. And there's mixed, you know, whereby one's doing something that's kind of good, but you're doing it in a slightly dodgy or shady way, you know. Like maybe you might be saying you're looking after your kids, but you're doing it by, you know, kind of being unpleasant to your neighbours. Yeah. So it's mixed. You know, you're looking after your dog, but you're killing fleas or something like that. So it's mingled. And then there's the karma that leads to the end of karma, which you said this is the and this is really the quality of mindfulness, mindful awareness. So when we develop the ethical basis, it means we're actually providing a foundation whereby we really have something we can witness. Because we are ethically based, it's painful and unpleasant to have to witness rage, fear, resentment, bitterness, and so forth. It's just you really feel the unpleasantness of that. So, but when the ethical quality is good, then hey, you know, then being mindful is much more possible because your mind is not agitated, it's not defensive, it's not shifting. You can live with this. So, then mindfulness comes as a natural quality, and it's to just recognize that one of the founding conditions for mindfulness is this. Conscience and concern, hiriyotapa, that is considered to be a guiding or a causative foundation for the arising of mindfulness. Because without that, you don't want to look at yourself. You don't want to be with it, that mind state. But when the mind state is good, then yeah, you can be with this when it's not tight, joyful. So very important to see how these work. And then to take the opportunity when you do meditate to bring these to mind. You know, we can be living very good lives and doing a lot of good. And you come to meditate, we remember the little things we did wrong. You bring to mind the regrets or the worries. Or maybe I should have said that. Or what will I do tomorrow? Or how will he be next week? You know. So we don't bring to mind the virtues and the goodness that's present. So you're making the choice with mindfulness, you set up something whereby your mindfulness is appropriate because it intensifies. You know, if anybody been on retreat, you recognize some of the absurd images and ideas that run through the mind. Because you know you're less distracted, whatever you think or feel, it becomes five times more intense. You can find yourself obsessed with sugar or tea, or, you know, the monks always, we always joke about this because it's a very common experience in monasteries. You know, you find yourself obsessed with the kind of robes you're wearing, or the kind of watch, whether kind of watch strap you got, or the kind of bag you've got, or you know, completely absurd things, because you know the mindfulness makes the whole process of your mind that much more intensely felt. So you want to gather your mindfulness around those qualities that are uplifting. Now, mindfulness, though it does actually focus and bear something in mind, this is its salient feature, is it bears and holds something present. Itself, it's ethically neutral. You may bring to mind ethically supportive qualities, but mindfulness is ethically neutral. And this is significant because it's actually, mindfulness is that which leads to the end of karma. Now, when we see karma is actually ethically driven, then you want to get to a place where the ethical basis is now sorted and finished. You know, it's established. There's enough of that. Yeah. And now we come to what we call the imperturbable. The mind is steady. So we don't need to keep, changing or improving the current. Because if this is where you begin to find yourself getting into the whole sense of becoming, where you're trying to become the most virtuous, or you worry about little tiny things you might have done wrong in the past, where the virtue actually becomes something that gets captured by the sense of becoming, self-improvement. So all of us have things in our past, I'm sure, that we regret, or we could have done better. So it's not to aim for a kind of narcissistic, ultra-angelic purity, but the right now intention is good, and it's gathered together in the right way. And then you come to, then when we realize that, in the sense of the, now it's time to move towards something that's more imperturbable. And how does this support the ending of these biases? The ending of the running on to make things change, to make things an other. To keep going. As you very familiar, you know, mindfulness is called the nimitta of samadhi. It's a phrase. Nimitta means a sign or a characteristic, the salient characteristic. So the defining characteristic of samadhi is the four foundations of mindfulness. That's, if you like, their territory, their domain. You know, samadhi is based upon this domain of the four foundations of mindfulness, four arisings, four establishments of mindfulness. So it's something that, because mindfulness bears something in mind, you bears the right thing in mind for long enough, you know, then your mind gets unified and calmed into a good, steady space, and this is what we call samadhi. It's a wholesome quality. And that has a sense of well-being in it. So recognizing that there's a quality of well-being that arises from ethics, that is in fact intensified, but made more stabilized by process of meditation. We calm and we satisfy ourselves. Yeah. We refresh and enjoy and rest. Into this way, where the kind of nervous agitations and fluctuations of attention become, we can see these are unnecessary. We have a choice. We have a choice, and we have a way in which we can smooth these out. This is our ongoing practice of samadhi. bhavana, cultivation that way, because it's making us feel better, well-being. So you get, if you like, virtue, truthfulness, which is mindfulness, and then well-being. Now these three come together in through practice of meditation. Now in terms of how the ending of karma, you know, it's said that, you know, one who cultivates samadhi and will, you know, tends towards a very beautiful immaterial rebirth. So if there's nothing more than that, then we are there's a rebirth, the wave, if you like, flows to the Brahmaloka, which is not bad news, is it? But the Buddha said, I say, when you have this kind of skill and faculty, don't just opt for the Brahmaloka. You know, if you've got this, make the choice to head on out. You know, when you've got this amount of good stuff going for you, then even the Brahmaloka isn't the best place to aim for. You know, you're aiming for the ending, which is the giving up of the push, the wave current itself. This is done through really the process of careful and examination of the nature of being. What constitutes? So it was called sometimes the five aggregates. You know, form, feeling, the physical form or the sense of there being form, substance, material. We feel ourselves somehow as being an object that's impinged upon. You know, I feel I'm a kind of lump with things that kind of happen to me, moves around, it's got weight and heat, in this sense. And then feeling, pleasure, pain, all kinds of cognitive impressions. I recognize things, things remind me of something. You know, that gives me a sense of who I am, what my memories and cognitions are. That's happening to me all the time. And then what's called sankhara, which are the very energies that drive, so the intentions, the motivations, the inclinations, the impulses, the instincts, some of them chosen, some of them blurred. And then the quality of awareness, self-consciousness, which is continually bringing, arising with every contact and kind of informing me of seeing, and I'm the one who sees. It informs me of hearing, and I'm the one who hears. It informs me of touching, and I'm the one who touches, and so forth. So out of the kind of matrix of these, there seems to be a subject who all this is happening to, right? Because of seeing, there's someone who does the seeing. Who's that? Where is he? Because of the arising of cognition, there must be somebody who's remembering, and where is he? Where did he go? You see him? Who is he? Because there's a form, there must be somebody inside it. You ever opened up one of these? Find out who's in there? Where is he? Because of this kind of impulses and volitions, there must be somebody there doing it. Who's that? And of course, you know, every time we ask the question, you're going to go, well, can't see it, can't find it, can't know it. And yet that's the one who's suffering. But who? And yet we can't find it. And yet that's the one who's suffering. So in one way, we find it all the time. You know, it's the one who feels not enough, got to have more of this, shouldn't be like that, or well, why has that happened to me, or remember that, or, you know, that's the one who's doing that, that's the one who's suffering. And yet, so in one way it's blatantly obvious, another way it's completely mysterious. So this is what we begin to probe, and realizing this whole sense of the self is built out of the kind of interplay of these aggregates. And of all of those aggregates, the one you really need to concern yourself with, what's actually doing the playing, and this is the sankhara. That's the only one that has the energy. That's the volition. That's the impulse. And that's the one that's driving karma. So chetana, or volition, is the primary sankhara. That is the key behind karma. Karma is based upon these sankharas, these volitional impulses that keep happening. Sankharas are that which provide the sense of self and me and continuity, because they bring to mind a memory. They bring to mind a language. They keep bringing to mind certain sense objects. Every morning I wake up, I remember it's me again. I don't have to figure out who I am, look in my passport, it just all comes there. Every day, every moment, something chooses what to rest upon, what particular sense object. This is pleasant, this is agreeable, this is necessary, this is frightening. Something's choosing and steering, isn't it? And something sees something and says, oh, that reminds me of, boop. You know? You contemplate the act of remembering something. When you, first of all, you don't remember it, you can feel something's actually driving, saying, where is it, where is it, where is it, where is it? That energy, that is sankhara, and it's rough, going through the filing cabinet. Is it Susan, is it Jackie, is it Doris, is it, no, it's Carol, that's her name. You can feel the energy moving. That is the sankhara. And in some sense, this is just functional. You know, we've got to operate. So they don't cease in this lifetime. There's no ceasing of that. You recognize that Buddhas and Arahants, they've still got sankharas. They're still out there. They're remembering who they are. They come out of meditation, they know who they are, they know where to go for alms. They're completely functional. They're not kind of scrambled. You know. So something is there making the choices, saying, you know, get up, walk, this is how you walk, this is where to go, and so forth. You know. That's functional. So these are people who have no karma. And yet they still have this kind of energy that is bringing them together as a functioning being. But it's not bringing them together as a suffering being. So if you like, there's one particular element of sankhara, only one, that you need to relinquish, and it's the unnecessary one. It's the enigmatic one. It's the one that says me. Which isn't about a function. It's not about how to operate. It's about creating something. So you see what that is. Like, you know, you look around and you say, okay, this is the lights, this is the door, this is the there's my handbag. Different, feels different. You know? You look around and you say, there's my son. And the my bit, you feel the difference between just noticing something and noticing something as mine. You look around the parking lot, there's cars, and then there's my car. It's got a different kind of quality to it. Actually, the car in itself is just the same. It's just another car. Yet my one, if it's scratched or dented or stolen, has got a huge whack of suffering built into it. So this is the one that we need to let go of or relinquish. And this is in fact what you begin to cultivate in meditation, because you can't just relinquish it on an external level. You know, you let go of your wristwatch, you let go of your car, you still hang on to your one's pride or one's knowledge or one's self-impressions. So it just shifts in that way. Renunciation on an external level only takes you so far. But relinquishment is the internal process of where is this self-view happening, and to recognize that self-view is not a philosophical statement, it's an energy that attracts, that pulls, that puts, sets things on fire. Yeah. That makes a feeling mine happening to me, and therefore burningly important. And so, but then in the process of practice, you're beginning to actually feel that, acknowledge what that is an experience, that sankhara is an experience. So it's rather like there's an analogy, you know, when you're really contemplating in your meditation of where is the element that is unnecessary and source of suffering, stress. And it's the sense of the self-view. Sometimes it's difficult to see. It's rather like the analogy of somebody's got, say, he's got 10 horses, you know. And so this person's riding around. He says, I only see 9 horses. Where's the 10th horse? Somebody says, I've got 10 horses. You don't see the horse you're riding on. So you say, I can only see 9 horses here. I can see them perfectly well and don't like the look of these and so forth. But I don't see the 10th horse. I must have lost it somewhere. Somebody's stolen my horse. You know? And it's the one you're riding on. And that's the one that counts. Yeah. So, as we meditate and begin to feel out where the sense of something that's holding or tightening in our minds and holding it together and pulling, and it's a kind of volitional, acquisitive sense. And in meditation experiences, have I got there yet? Am I getting there yet? Am I doing it yet? Will I be there yet? Or I've got it together now. I've sorted it. Now I'm here. Now I'm at this stage. Now I'm at that stage. That's the one you want to know. And you're mindful and aware of that. Can there be a relinquishment, a relaxing of that? The 10th horse is the one you want to go for. And you can experience it, particularly as your mind becomes more still in meditation. There's something not still. As your mind becomes calm in meditation, something that's not quite calm. There's something tense. As your mind becomes even in meditation, something that's not quite, there's a little lump somewhere. That's the one, that's the sankhara, the one that counts. And you're lining the others up in meditation. You're lining up the other energies, the energy of the mind, the sankhara of the mind, so that when it's kind of steady enough, you've got something, where's the unsteady one here? Where's the pushy one here? Where's the grasping one here? It's that one. And you see the horse, the 10th horse. So, in a way, in practice, we are, through the laws of cause and effect, generating a kind of stillness, a kind of well-being, a kind of a fulfillment to recognize this, the 10th horse. Because if everything's running around every which way, you're too distracted to really notice these refined points. So you put them all together, and you begin to sense where this kind of doesn't have to be absolutely still, but just you can recognise it's relatively still, and there's something there that's pushing or hanging on. Or that's the one. And once you begin to recognise that, you feel it. Then in a way this becomes a kind of a sign that you take out of meditation, because it's the one that flares up in your daily life. It's the one that gets angry or upset or righteous or whatever. And then you've begun to learn about that one, the one that really shouts me. Yeah, and mine. That's the whole source of one's dukkha. And it's not a person, it's a particular, a tangled up energy. So you bring in mindful awareness to that, and you begin to release and relax that. Because when you do, there's an intrinsic quality of well-being. So just as we're ethically centered beings, also our true fulfillment is through the elimination, the eradication of this self-view. We'll never really be satisfied and contented until we've begun to smooth that out and relinquish that one. And this is something you can do in meditation and in terms of your renunciation, in terms of morality to others as to myself, a kindness and compassion. It's the unifying feature of the path. So then this is the ending. In a way, Buddhas, Arahants continue to live their sankharas, still generate perceptions, sense consciousness, and so forth, but the something has stopped. The sankhara that carries the karma of rebirth has stopped. And so for that, their lives are then for the welfare of others, for the welfare of themselves. It's for welfare. So I offer this for your welfare, and I hope there's something there that you can take home and bear in mind. I hope it's of use to you. Thank you for listening.